Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland. I'm your host Fraser, and today this is episode 41, 12th and 13th century military tactics. In our last episode, we traversed the European landscape of the 1100s to 1200s, uncovering Scotland's multifaceted interactions with the continental powers. We delved into how Scotland was perceived by its neighbours, from the intricacies of the relationship with England, to its diplomatic ties with the kingdoms of the Iberian Peninsula, France and the Holy Roman Empire. We even touched upon the cultural and trade exchanges, with Flanders a hub of medieval commerce. It was a narrative that showcased Scotland not as an isolated entity, but as a vibrant and integral part of the medieval European continuity and community. But today, we turn our attention to something I've been looking forward to for quite a bit now, and to a different yet equally fascinating aspect of Scottish history, military tactics. The 12th and 13th centuries were defining periods for Scottish warfare, marked by significant evolutions in how battles were fought. In this episode, we will delve deep into the heart of medieval Scottish military strategies. What were the tactics employed by the Scots during these tumultuous times? How did they adapt to the challenges of warfare? And how did the unique Scottish landscape shape their approaches to combat? Imagine the scene, the mist-covered highlands, the clanging of iron, the cries of warriors echoing through the valleys. This era was characterised by fierce battles, strategic manoeuvrings, and the unyielding spirit of Scottish fighters, from the construction of imposing fortresses to the cunning use of terrain in battles. Scottish warfare was as much about brains as it was about brawn. Join me as we explore the evolution of Scottish warfare, and we'll examine the composition of the Scottish armies, who were these warriors who bravely fought for their land. We'll delve deeper into the key battles, who were the Scottish commanders, and of course we'll have a look at the weapons and armour that were the tools of the trade for these medieval soldiers. So, let's don our metaphorical armour, grasp our imaginary swords and shields, and step into the world of 12th and 13th century Scottish military tactics, from the rugged highlands to the stormy seas. We'll uncover how Scotland defended its land, its people, and its king. Are you ready to journey back in time and explore the art of medieval warfare? Let us begin. As we delve into the Scottish evolution during the 12th and 13th century of warfare, it becomes clear that this period of significant transformation, as we know with David I, the way Scots waged war, defended their lands and engaged with their enemies, underwent profound changes influenced by a myriad of factors both at home and abroad. The 12th century saw Scotland in a period of transition. Early in this era, the traditional methods of warfare, which were largely based on a light infantry employing hit-and-run tactics, began to evolve. The influence of Norman military methods, characterised by the use of heavy cavalry and the construction of stone castles, started to permeate Scotland, especially after David I and the nobles began arriving in Scotland. By the 13th century, Scottish warfare had absorbed these influences from the Norman conquest and David and the Norman nobles, leading to a more diverse and sophisticated military approach. The use of heavy cavalry became more pronounced, even though it wasn't as gigantic as the French cavalry or the British army when they had the long demolishing heavy cavalry. It still was quite decent in size, and especially among the nobility, they began to see such forces as a status of symbol and a powerful tool on the battlefield. The Scots also started to adapt the use of crossbows and longbows as in a crucial range component to their arsenal. Internally, the ongoing process of feudalisation under the kings like David paved a way for a pivotal role in shaping Scottish military tactics. The introduction of feudal levies, where vassals were obliged to provide military service, led to a more organised and structured approach to raising armies. The establishment of boroughs under David also contributed to military evolution, as these became centres for commerce, which in turn supported the logistics of maintaining armies. So logistics meaning supplying the food, the water, and housing for moving military armies throughout the land. Another significant internal factor was a need to defend against internal conflicts and rebellions. The diverse terrain of Scotland, from the Highlands to the Lowlands, required adaptable and versatile military strategies. Externally, Scotland's position between England and the Norse territories meant constant exposure to different military ideas and tactics. The continuous skirmishes and conflicts with England, especially during the reigns of kings like Alexander II and Alexander III, two kings who we'll get onto very shortly in our history of Scotland, forced Scotland to adapt and respond to the well-organised and financed English armies. Additionally, the North's influence, particularly in the western and northern parts of Scotland, brought different aspects of maritime warfare and raids into Scottish military practice. The Scots learned and adapted techniques from Norse warriors, known for their swift and brutal raids. Also, the Crusades played a role as Scots participated in these religious wars, bringing back knowledge and experience from the broader European theatre. The contact with different cultures and military techniques during the Crusades enriched Scottish warfare and its strategies. In conclusion, the 12th and 13th centuries were formative in the evolution of Scottish military tactics. The blend of internal political and social changes, coupled with external pressures and influences, created a warfare complex and tapestry of old and new, traditional and borrowed, forming a unique and effective approach to military engagements that would serve Scotland well in the tumultuous centuries to follow. But what was the composition of these Scottish armies? Well, if we jump through the different style of units, I've already mentioned one of them, and that was the heavy cavalry. Influenced by the Norman warfare, the Scottish armies began incorporating heavy cavalry. These knights, often from the nobility, were armoured and rode well-bred war horses. They were crucial in open battles, charging enemy lines or protecting their flanks, but they weren't as diverse, well-armoured, or in greater number as their English counterparts. There was, of course, the light infantry and archers. The backbone of Scottish armies was still the light infantry, comprising of foot soldiers armed with spears, axes, and sometimes bows. They were suited for the rugged Scottish terrain, allowing, especially in the Highlands, archers, including those skilled with a longbow, becoming increasingly important during this period, allowing them to traverse these Highlands a lot more effectively. There was the galloglass and sculptrons. Unique to Scotland and Ireland were the galloglass mercenary warriors of Norse Gaelic origin, known for their fierce fighting skills and heavy axes. Additionally, the Scots developed the sculptrum, a formation of dense spearmen effective against cavalry. Now, this is something we'll see in the famous Battle of Bannockburn, but we'll leave the sculptrum for a later episode for us to delve into. What about the recruitment and training? Well, we know of the feudal system, lords and nobles were obliged to provide a certain number of troops to the king for a fixed period each year. These levies formed the core of Scottish armies, with knights providing the cavalry and lesser vassals and tenants serving as the infantry. In times of need, especially during larger conflicts, local lords could call upon common levies, who were ordinary freemen who were required to serve. These levies would include farmers and townsmen who might not have had the formal military training. And of course, there was the mercenaries, including the famed galloglass, who were employed providing specialised skills and bolstering the army's ranks. Now, armies were usually maintained through the feudal system, where each lord was responsible for provisioning its own troops. In the case of larger campaigns, the king's resources and contributions from the church and boroughs played a crucial role in supplying the army. Training varied significantly. While knights received extensive training in combat and tactics, the common levies had minimal formal training. Lords would often train their personal retinues and communal military exercises, known as weaponshires, who were held at a more basic level of preparedness. In summary, the composition of Scottish armies in the 12th and 13th centuries reflected a blend of traditional Scottish warfare practices and influences from Norman and European military systems. The feudal structure played a central role in recruitment and maintenance, while training ranged from the rigorous preparation of knights to the more rudimentary training of common levies. this diverse and adaptable composition was key to the success of Scottish armies during this period. But how did these evolving strategies and maneuvers of Scottish commanders affect in the notable battles of this era? Now, one of these notable battles that we keep going on about is the Battle of the Standard in 1138 AD. We know this was one of the most iconic battles during this period, and it was fought near Northampton in 1138. The battle pitted the Scottish forces led by our dead and deceased King David I against the English army. The Scottish army comprised a mix of heavy cavalry, light infantry and archers, and it faced a well-organised English force known for its formidable infantry and archers. The Skultrum formation, the Scots employed the Skultrum formation, a dense phalanx of spearmen designed to counter cavalry charges. This formation, however, proved less effective against the disciplined volleys of English archers. Now, there was also the cavalry charges. We know about this. We know the nobles, I think it was John Baliol, he led the formidable charge of the Scots. And despite having a formidable cavalry, the Scots were unable to fully utilise this asset due to the terrain and disciplined ranks of the English soldiers. It wasn't as effective. This battle demonstrated the limitations of traditional Scottish tactics against well-coordinated infantry and archery, leading to a revaluation of military strategies in subsequent years. Now, a battle that we haven't really touched upon, because it is in our future, is the Battle of Alnwick, and this was during the reign of William the Lion. So I won't spoil it too much, but during this battle against King Henry II, the Scots employed a strategy of rapid movement and surprise, hoping to capture the strategic important castle of Alnwick. But, however, due to the lack of proper reconnaissance, it led to a surprise encounter with the English forces, resulting in some, let's say, a loss. I won't spoil what happens when we get to William the Lion's reign. You'll understand why I don't want to spoil it properly, but yeah, it didn't have a great ending. I'll put it that like that. Throughout these centuries, Scottish commanders frequently used specific strategies and manoeuvres in their battles. There was use of terrain, of course. The commanders were adept at using Scotland's rugged terrain to their advantage. But when they invaded England, that was a little bit more difficult as they weren't from England and they didn't understand the terrain as much. Light infantry excelled in hit-and-run tactics, especially in the Highlands, harassing enemy supply lines and avoiding open field battles against superior forces. Hence, why ever England would invade Scotland, they would struggle. There was also the construction and use of castles and fortresses, and this became increasingly important, both for defence and as basis for launching raids. Recognising the need to counter different threats, Scottish commanders adapted their army's composition, gradually incorporating more heavy cavalry and ranged units. In conclusion, the key battles and strategies, even though we didn't go too much into detail because I don't want to spoil the future episodes, the commanders learned from both their victories and defeats, mainly a lot of defeats, but hey ho, gradually evolving their approaches to meet the challenges of their time. These developments laid the foundation for future military successes and the enduring legacy of Scottish martial prowess. Now, in the tapestry of medieval warfare, fortifications were the stones and mortar of defence, while siege warfare often became more protracted and grueling test of an army's might. For Scotland, between the 12th and 13th centuries, the approach to these aspects of warfare was not just about martial prowess, but also about the assertion of sovereignty and protection of the realm. As the Scottish landscape began to bristle with the construction of castles, a transformation was underway. From the wooden ramparts of yesteryears to the more formidable stone fortifications, this shift was indicative of Scots' understanding of changing dynamics of warfare and the need for a more permanent and resilient structure. These castles, often perched upon hills or nestled beside rivers, served dual purposes. They were symbols of the feudal lord's power as we know, but they were practical tools for control in surrounding territories. The castles of Scotland, such as Edinburgh Castle, which saw significant development as we know, were not mere military bastions. They were administrative centres, seats of the lords and refugees for the surrounding populations in times of war. Edinburgh's castle's location atop an extinct volcanic crag made it a daunting challenge for any would-be besieger, a testament to the strategic acumen of medieval Scottish fortification. Siege warfare, the shadow dance to the steadfast of castles, was an equal nuanced affair. Scottish sieges were often lengthy endeavours requiring patience, real resources and integrity. The Scots, both as defenders and attackers, had to adapt at a variety of techniques, mining and sapping, where attackers would undermine the castle's wall, were very much met with countermining by the defenders. Siege engines such as trebuchets, which were introduced a lot later on, and mangonels were constructed to hurl stones and over projectiles over walls to batter them into submission. An example of this intense nature of siege warfare in this era was the Siege of Roxburgh in 1174. The castle, held by the English, was a vital stronghold near the Scottish-English border. Our future king, King William the Lion, attempted to recapture the fortress, but the embellishment of the siege tactics of the time, a blend of direct assault and blockade aiming to starve the defenders into surrender. Though this particular siege ended abruptly with William's defeat at Alnwick, it underscored the centralness of a siege in territorial conflicts of this era. In the 12th and 13th centuries as well, we obviously had the arms, the armour and the equipment of Scottish soldiers. They were pivotal in unfolding the Scottish warfare machine. The period saw a gradual evolution in military gear, reflecting broader changes in medieval warfare and influenced by both internal developments and external contacts. The different types of arms and armour were swords and spears. The sword remained a symbol of the warrior class, with its design gradually evolving. Knights and noblemen often wielded swords that were both a status symbol and an effective weapon. The spear, however, was more widespread, used by both infantry and cavalry due to its versatility and ease of production. Bows and crossbows. Archery gained an importance during this period. The longbow, although not as prominent as it would be in later centuries, especially in England, was used alongside the crossbow, a powerful weapon that required less skill than the longbow, but it was more effective at piercing armour. There was, of course, axes and maces. They were common against infantry, especially where the cost or availability of swords was prohibitive. This axe in particular was a traditional weapon in Scotland, with its use continuing from earlier periods. What about the armour and protective gear? Well, there was mail hauberks. By the 12th century, the use of mail hauberks, a type of armour made of interlocking metal rings, became more widespread in Scotland, especially among the nobility and knights. This provided significant protection against cutting and thrusting of weapons. Helmets. The canonical nasal helmet was common, evolving into a more sophisticated design by the 13th century. Helmets were crucial in protecting the head and neck in battle. Shields. Round or kited shields were used, with the latter being particularly popular among cavalry as it offered more protection to the rider's left side. Now, the evolution and impact on warfare. The introduction of heavier armour and the use of cavalry warfare inspired by Norman practices led to the evolution of Scottish military tactics as we know. The combination of heavy cavalry with the traditional light infantry tactics gave Scottish armies greater versatility. The evolution of arms and armour also impacted siege warfare. Defenders of castles and fortifications had to deal with increasingly effective siege engines and projectile weapons. But despite the changes, the Scottish infantry remained a crucial component of the military, especially the light infantry. The combination of traditional weapons like axes with more advanced armours and tactical use of terrain ensured that Scottish infantry could hold their own against more heavily armoured opponents. In summary, the evolution of arms and armour, especially during the 12th and 13th century, Scotland significantly influenced its military tactics and capabilities. This period saw a blend of traditional Scottish fighting methods with newer, often foreign, influences, resulting in a versatile and formidable military force. And I think that's the key here. It's the blend of the old to the new, the gradual incorporation of Norman practices into this Scottish fighting machine. Now, what about naval warfare during the 12th and 13th century? That's something we haven't really touched upon. Well, Scotland's naval warfare during the 12th and 13th century was primarily defensive. The primary concern was protecting the coastlines from the invasions and raids, particularly from the Norse and English forces. Scotland's geographical position, with its extensive coastline and proximity to Norse territories, made it vulnerable to seaborne attacks. The Norse Viking influence in Scotland, especially in the northern and western parts, had a significant impact on Scottish naval practices. The Scots adapted some of the Norse shipbuilding techniques and tactics, which were crucial for patrolling and defending their waters. One of the key maritime strategies was the use of small fleets of galleys or small longships for coastal defence. Yes, these are like Norse longships. These vessels were adept at navigating the challenging Scottish waters and could be used effectively for quick responses to raids. The maritime strategies also included protecting trade routes and merchant shipping. The economic prosperity of Scotland, particularly in the burgeoning trade centres like Perth, Dundee, were partially dependent on secure sea routes. Scotland also used maritime strategies as a tool for diplomacy and forming alliances. Alliances with maritime powers such as the Norse kingdoms or certain factions in Ireland were crucial for ensuring maritime security. The effectiveness of Scottish naval strategies in this era was mixed. While they were successful in defending against smaller raids and protecting their trade, Scotland's naval forces were generally not strong enough to contend with larger feats, such as those of England. The limited resources dedicated to naval warfare meant that Scotland often relied on defensive tactics, coastal patrols, and strategic alliances rather than building a large navy. Now, the participation of Scotland in foreign wars and the Crusades during the 12th and 13th centuries had a notable impact on its military tactics and technology. Scottish involvement in the Crusades, particularly during the later 12th and 13th centuries, brought its soldiers into contact with advanced military techniques from both the European Crusaders and Muslim forces. Exposure to siege warfare in the Levant, for instance, influenced Scottish siege tactics and fortification designs. The crossbow, which was widely used in the Crusades, was one such technology that found its way back to Scotland. Its effectiveness, especially against heavily armoured opponents, made it a valuable addition to the Scottish arsenal. Experiences from the Crusades also led to the adaption of horse armour and the improvement of heavy cavalry tactics. The knights who returned from the Holy Land brought with them new ideas about cavalry charges, formations, which was then seen in Scottish warfare. Now, these Crusades we will touch upon, there are obviously the Second and Third Crusades and the eventual Fourth Crusades as well. I'm probably going to cover that in maybe two episodes coming in the future. I'm not sure if I'm going to be doing that before the Scottish fight for independence or after, but regardless, don't worry, we are going to have a catch up on the Crusades. Second, third and fourth, and we'll, you know, discuss what happened and how the Levant was slowly recaptured by the Muslim forces. Now, the ongoing conflicts with England, which had adapted Norman warfare techniques, forced Scotland to modify its military strategies. The Scots learned to counter the well-organised English heavy cavalry and longbowmen, adapting their infantry tactics and formations accordingly. The involvement in conflicts with maritime nations such as Norway also enhanced Scottish naval tactics, especially with the Norse in terms of ship design and coastal defence. The use of mercenaries from different parts of Europe introduced new tactics and weapons to the Scottish armies as well. Gallowglass warriors, for example, brought distinct Gaelic Norse fighting styles, which were incorporated into the Scottish methods of warfare. What about the terrain though? Scotland's rugged terrain and often harsh climate played a pivotal role in shaping its military strategies and tactics during these centuries. The Scottish islands, where the steep mountains and the deep glens were particularly suited for guerrilla tactics. Scottish forces often used these areas to launch surprise attacks or to evade larger invading armies, which we'll see in the coming episodes, especially in the Scottish Independence Wars. The terrain allowed for hit-and-run tactics, which were particularly effective against heavily armoured but less mobile enemy forces. The numerous marshes and rivers across Scotland also influenced military strategies. Commanders often used these natural barriers to their advantage. we know in the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314, although just beyond the period under our discussion here, it's a prime example of how terrain was used to great effect. But we'll save the explanation of how our Robert the Bruce used the terrain in the Battle of Bannockburn to his advantage for a future episode. The strategic placement of castles and fortifications, as we know, on elevated ground or near key waterways was a direct response to the terrain. These castles served as strong defensive points and bases from which to control the surrounded areas. What about the impact on climate? That's something we don't really hear a lot. The harsh Scottish winters often dictated the timing of military campaigns. Armies typically avoided major campaigns during the winter months due to the challenges of moving and supplying troops. Scottish armies were adept at manoeuvring in various weather conditions, however, a necessity given the often unpredictable Scottish climate. They were known for their ability to march and fight effectively in rain and cold, which could be debilitating to unacclimatised invading armies. The climate also impacted naval operations. The rough seas around Scotland, particularly during the autumn and winter, could hinder maritime movements. As such, naval campaigns were carefully planned around the more favourable conditions of spring and summer. But this kind of provided Scotland with an extra defence layer. The layer of climate, the coldness during the winter, how cold and wet it became, the unpredictability of the Scottish waters around Scotland was a defence layer and gave Scotland an extra layer of protection against external forces. But as we wrap up today's exploration into the fascinating world of 12th and 13th century Scottish military tactics, again, it's important to acknowledge the rich array of sources that have informed our journey through Scotland's martial past. The insights and knowledge shared in this episode were drawn from a variety of historical texts and scholarly works. I'm doing this probably for the last time in this episode. When we get back to our political narrative, I will try and incorporate our insights of knowledge from the historical texts and sources, but it's really hard to fit in sources at the end of an episode that is going on for so long. But again, for these three episodes I've done, I really wanted to give you guys extra reading if you wanted to. Anyway, some of the key references in this episode include Scottish Warfare, From the Battle of Standard to Flodden by Michael Brown, which provides an in-depth look at the evolution of Scottish military practices. Warfare in Medieval Scotland by Alistair J. MacDonald offers a comprehensive analysis of tactics, strategies and changes in Scottish warfare during this period. Finally, The Scottish Soldier and Empire, 1854-1902 by Edward M. Spears, while focusing on a later period, gives context to the long-standing traditions of Scottish military strategy and prowess. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed delving into the world of medieval Scottish warfare. Those are the sources. Feel free to research them further if you want further reading. Again, as I said, I'll try and incorporate sources into future political episodes, but it's a lot easier when we're doing these standalone episodes to reference the sources. Anyway, hope you've understood more of the tactics and strategies that shaped the battles and conflicts of the 12th and 13th centuries. From the rugged highlands to the stormy North Sea, we've seen how Scotland's landscape, climate, and external influences all played a pivotal part in moulding its military history. Looking ahead, our next episode promises to be equally captivating as we begin the tale, finally, of David I's grandson, Malcolm IV. It's time to dive back into the political narrative of Scotland's past. I'm excited to guide you through the life and times of Malcolm IV and then his heir, William the Lion, a king who faced his own unique set of challenges and triumphs. Remember, as always, our podcast episodes are released weekly and we're committed to bringing you three episodes a month, each filling with intriguing historical insights. The next episode will be the last one of this month, and then the next episodes will be in December, towards the Christmas and New Year period. But to stay updated, join in the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHistoryOfSE1, that is, at TheHistoryOfSE1, or join our Facebook community at The History of Scotland Podcast. Thank you very much for the recent follows on Twitter and especially the new members in the Facebook community. We're now up to 40 members. It's great. Let's see if we can push for 50 or 60 members by the start of the new year. Your engagement, questions and discussions enrich our journey through Scotland's history, so thank you for the ongoing support regardless. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a review on your preferred platform, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts or Podbean. Our podcast is also available on other great podcasting platforms, so do have a look. Your feedback helps us grow and improve, and I do want to say thank you for the latest Spotify reviews that have popped up. Thank you very much for those 5-star reviews. I'm glad everyone's enjoying the journey. Anyway, thank you for joining me today. I look forward to our next historical adventure as we continue to unravel the rich tapestry of Scotland's past. But until then, stay safe, guys. Have a great week, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace.